Next to Features interview. Today we have a fabulous director who's got an amazing documentary that everybody should see. He will tell you at the end where to find it, but I will tell you the documentary is called Facing East and it's not what you expect. Hey, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I guess we got to start right at the beginning. How did you stumble on this?
Well, that's exactly what happened. I just kind of stumbled on it. Me and some friends had been doing some videos and some documentary work. We were kind of just getting going with it. And a buddy of mine was at a cemetery, not at Eastern Cemetery, but another one here in Louisville. And there was a guy there cutting the grass, and they just got to talking about shooting video and doing documentaries. And the guy said, well, I'm part of a nonprofit like volunteer group that volunteers over at this cemetery, and you really got to come over and hear the story. So my buddy kind of got with me and we went down there and talked to the people and just kind of grew from there. And it was really, I mean, it took multiple years before we found everything out that is in the documentary. It was, I mean, right off the bat, it was crazy, but then just it got more and more and more. Like I thought, you know, this can't get any weirder. And then it did several more times.
Okay, so randomly your friend, that's what I understand this, runs into some guy cutting grass.
Right.
And tells you a story, and you guys are like, hey, I'm going to go check this out. So how many years did you spend on this project before you put it to film? Or were you filming the whole time?
Well, we went down there the first time in August of 2013, and we really had the movie kind of done in 2017, but then we kind of went through the process of finding a distributor and, you know, all that is entailed there. And then it was released in March of 2019. So about 5 or 6 years that we were working on it.
I guess we got to start with the action. What are people's reactions to this film?
Oh, I mean, I've had all kinds. You know, there's a lot of people that I've talked to that have family there or that were involved with the group that cleans up there. And so, I mean, I've gotten a lot of like, you know, thank you so much for like telling this story. We're so happy to have it come out. And then I've definitely gotten people that are like, oh my gosh, you know, like that are just horrified by it, which I mean, I think we all are really, you know.
So when you start off, you showed me some old footage and basically you've done some research. I mean, it looks like you guys spent a lot of time researching this. Where did your old footage come from right off the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, we really did put a lot of time into the research. The stuff at the very beginning, I just went down to Frankfurt to the public record, and they had some of the court tapes where they had recorded the actual proceedings of, I guess it was the civil trial. We were never able to get any footage of the actual criminal trial. I don't think it actually went to trial, the criminal case. I'm not really sure. But then there was also like just tons of documents, and there was actually several cases that went on from this, but the initial one that you see there at the beginning is 1989, the case that began then. And it was crazy that we found those tapes. And then there's also some video footage that was actually filmed by the cop who went down there and was investigating it. And it was like stuff that he was filming to use, I guess, you know, in his case. And we just happened to find the people that still had those tapes here in Louisville. And so we were able to use some of that as well.
Okay. To back you up, you state in a documentary at one point that they didn't file criminal charges against anybody because they didn't think they were really knew what was going on.
Well, yeah. So they kind of did. They walked the three main guys, they processed them. They never actually spent the night in jail, but then all those charges were completely dismissed. And there was like kind of some kind of a bargain where they had to be, you know, they couldn't get in any other kind of trouble for a year. There was some kind of a probation that was attached to it. And I think you even hear one of the attorneys talking about it in the movie. And she's saying that they violated that by returning to the cemetery. They weren't supposed to go back there. And I think that was just them maneuvering because they couldn't get them on anything. So they tried, you know, everything they could over several years to get these guys, and they just couldn't do it.
So how did you find the people to interview? Did the people cleaning the area, Friends of Eastern Cemetery, I think they're called?
Yeah, that was the main way. So Andy Harpole, who is kind of the leader and the founder of Friends of Eastern Cemetery, he was the main way that I was able to be introduced to a lot of the people that had family buried there. And then it also just kind of went on from there. There was a lot of just like Googling and searching Facebook and just like finding people. I would get like a document from court or find like a newspaper online or something and see somebody's name. And I would just like Google them and track them down. And we got lucky several times, which was just crazy.
Now, some people may have not wanted to discuss this story. Were both people forthcoming about this or no?
Yeah, most of them were, but there was definitely people who just said no. There was one time I was down at the cemetery, and I was just getting some B-roll and hanging out, and a lady came down there and visited a grave. She had had two twins that were buried there that died as infants, and I really wanted to get her because it went in with the story where the lady comes into the hospital room and sells them a grave, and then they ended up being buried in Section 19, Babyland. And I really wanted to interview this lady, but she just was like, no, I can't talk about it. I can't do it. Which was, I understood, you know, I wasn't upset about it, but I was like, just, oh my gosh, this would have been, you know, I really wanted a second person to corroborate that story. Because I did talk to a couple people, but that was the Debbie Medford that does talk about it as the only person I could get to go on camera.
Babyland, I would say, for most people, is probably the most disturbing part of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had some photos and stuff where they were digging there and everything. I mean, it is incredibly disturbing. Less than a foot deep graves for, like, scores of children. Just numerous, numerous infants buried there. Unmarked graves. They would sell people a gravestone and then not give it to them and just literally bury them right in there with somebody else. Very shallow. And even the gravedigger, Bob Allen, talks about how, he was like, oh, it was a baby grave. It was fine to only bury it like 2 feet deep, you know? And you're like, oh my gosh. Like, you know, he was a good guy, I think, but there was definitely some traditions there that were just within themselves not right.
Did you have any difficulty shooting in the cemetery at any time, or you pretty much had free reign?
No, I really only maybe one time, which I wasn't even there, but the guy who flew the drone for me went down there, and the DA, the Attorney General for Kentucky was in the cemetery that day. Or somebody from his department, and they like shut him down and said he couldn't fly the drone there. But for the most part, there was never anybody there, you know? I mean, you just kind of go there and it's empty. So, which is part of the problem too, because it's so big and people go back there, you know, and like do vandalism and homeless people sleep back there and stuff, too, just because really there is no supervision, unfortunately.
So is the old crematorium still accessible then in the back?
Okay, so yeah, the answer is no, but we did get in there. It's boarded up, but the we went in with some people and took the boards off and were able to shoot inside of there somewhat safely and then board it back up. But it's sort of, it's off limits definitely, like for anybody to go down there. There's a house in the front that's the original crematorium, and that is, it's still, people live there. It's like an apartment now. And it's like owned by a separate private person, who has like apartments he rents out, but the building in the very back is definitely part of the cemetery. So it's just kind of, you know, an abandoned piece of property, unfortunately.
So early on, I hear a song called Holes in the Ground. Who sung it and why does it fit your movie so perfectly?
Yeah, so the opening song is by Ryan Conroy, and he was just a friend of mine here in Louisville who was a musician. He did the score for the entire movie, and he wrote that song after watching the film. But he also had been down to the cemetery, you know, while we were working on the documentary. I mean, he was aware of it before I ever talked to him about it, and had been down there and hung out there. So he definitely felt a connection with it too, which I think played into that. But it was just really exciting to work with him because he was like a musician that I really look up to. And I just, he did such incredible work for that movie.
How did Frank Whitaker come on as the narrator for this project?
Frank's a good friend of mine. I've done some short films and some other like narrative work, and Frank is just like my go-to guy as far as acting. We've done a bunch of work together, so it was a no-brainer to ask him to do the narration for me. Definitely a lot of this was like, who will do this for cheap or free, like as a friend, as a favor, because they believe in the project too, but also because they believe in me. So that was where a lot of the decisions came from, but I was so lucky to have guys like Frank and Ryan to back me up, definitely.
So you said you did a lot of internet research. You also have a lot of newspaper articles you cut to in the film. Did you get more from the internet, or the newspapers guided you which way you needed to go?
Well, I probably started with the newspapers more than anything. Probably the first article I read was where the LA Times, I believe it was, reported on it in like 89 or 90 when everybody kind of first discovered what was going on. And then I found the database online for the Louisville Courier-Journal, which also includes like their predecessor or like the previous newspaper, which went all the way back to the 1840s. So that was like the entire run of the cemetery. So we just kind of found every article, and I can tell you, like, people report on this. It's on the news, on TV, like local news. Every year we hear about Eastern Cemetery, like locally. So there was like no shortage of documentation.
I guess I'm going to ask, since it comes on the news every year, what are they talking about? I mean, is there something, new developments that are happening?
I mean, not really. I guess there's small new developments with the volunteer group just kind of making progress and asking people for help. But overall, no, I think it's just kind of like they go back every couple of years and, okay, we're going to do another story on somebody that, you know, had a problem with a burial here. It's just still going. Like, it's crazy to me too, but it's definitely like I've seen it on the news numerous times over the years, and it's really mind-boggling that more hasn't been done about it, or you know, or that there isn't more attention given to it beyond just kind of like, and you actually, usually the news story is the grass is really high at Eastern Cemetery and there's these guys going down there and they're trying to cut it, but they need your help. So I mean, that's more than anything what they're talking about, is just like you know, metropolitan kind of coverage of it, like, hey guys, the grass is still really high over at Eastern Cemetery, stuff like that.
After making your documentary, do you feel anything is ever going to be done to fix the issues at Eastern Cemetery?
I think that Andy and the Friends of Eastern Cemetery are going to continue to grow, but beyond that, like, is something major going to be done? I don't even think that it would be possible to put the situation right. There's over 100,000 disturbed burials there. And the idea of even trying to go in after them and getting them, like, you would do more damage than you would good, trying to actually break ground and fix things. So I think it's really just about, ownership of the property, security. I mean, like, we should have like a secure entrance that can be gated and closed at night, and just like the repairs to the gravestones and setting new stones. I know the volunteers there have talked about like maybe a commemorative, like, you know, something they could put up and put the names of people that do not have stones, like on a big, you know, I don't know what, but like some kind of a memorial or something. So stuff like that, I think, is possible. But as far as fixing the real problem, it can't be fixed. And as well as all the people that bought graves there and that they owe money to, that could never use their grave, that nothing will ever be done about that. That's just like, we're going to look the other way and not, you know, and most of the people who are responsible at this point have passed on. So there's not a lot that can be done. But I do think that if the goal is to secure it and to make it look how it should have looked and was intended to look, you know.
So during your research, there's one thing you didn't touch on I was a little confused about. What happened to the headstones that were made? They just never made them? And they said some headstones you related to disappeared. Do you know what happened to those headstones?
Yeah, so I've all this is a lot of what I'm going to say here is things that people told me. So I don't have a lot of necessarily hard evidence, but it sounds like they kind of did every possible different version. Like a lot of times you would buy a grave and if they thought you might not ever show up, like they wouldn't even put a headstone in. There was definitely some down in the garage that had never been used that had people's names written on them, but had never actually been put in the ground. I don't know if that was just at the end when they got shut down and they just didn't finish that process. But also like historically over the years, they would go back and remove the headstones and probably bury them, destroy them, throw them in a dumpster. I don't know how they got rid of them, but they would like literally, you know, have an entire row of graves that had not been visited for 25, 40, whatever amount of years. And they would say, you know, we need some new real estate. I think some new real estate just opened up right over in that section that of those old graves that nobody visited. And what their process was of actually doing that, of getting rid of the gravestones or what they did, nobody can really say for sure. But there were stones there certainly that are no longer there now. And in a lot of cases, you know, big groups of them.
Bob Allen was the first whistleblower for this project. Did people hear rumors before he said anything, or you couldn't find any research on that?
So Bob Allen blew the whistle in 1989. And before that, I mean, there had been numerous newspaper articles that had reported on the problem there in various ways. I think it was like 1888. There was a newspaper article that said paupers are being buried in shallow graves, sometimes two or three to a grave. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it right in front of me, but there were allegations against them all throughout. There was a lawsuit about a kid that didn't get buried, or they buried him in the wrong grave or something, and the family got like $20,000, I think, in the early 80s. There was a bunch of lawsuits against them over the years for, you know, where you would a family would come back and expect to find the gravestone for mom and dad, and it wouldn't be there. And then they would, I think some people probably just thought they were confused or would let it go. I'm sure it happened way more times, but there were some people that definitely followed up on it. And I guess people would just say, well, it's an isolated incident. I don't think anybody ever was like, well, are they doing this everywhere in the whole cemetery? You know, I'm sure somebody said that, I would assume, but that doesn't seem to be what, you know, what we found that was being reported. So I think it just kind of flew under the radar for 150 years or so, which is just crazy.
Okay, so when they're reburying a section, just so I can understand this, they would bury the dig the grave out, put the body back in, and then fill it on top again?
Yeah, so it sounds like from Phil DeBlasi, the archaeologist, what he explained to me was there's a grave, a previous burial, so they're going to probably dig this whole hole. And while they're doing that, I mean, it's like with a big backhoe with like 4-inch steel like claws, you know, and they would just literally tear through these graves. And then, you know, that would be a part of the pile of dirt. They would put in the new burial and then just put all the dirt back in or get rid of it in some cases. Bob Allen talks about hitting previous burials when they went to dig graves. And he was instructed by Charles Alexander, you know, dig it deeper, put the previous burial on the bottom, put the new one on top, stuff like that. They had different methods, I think. But, yeah, they were literally just digging through them. And Phil DeBlasi said there's not entire skeletons down there from these previous burials. He said they're fractions of pieces, like the size of a pencil is how he described it. So again, you could never, it'd be very difficult to find like a full intact body from one of these previous burials. They probably exist down there, but the majority of them are just totally obliterated from being dug through.
I wanted to go a little bit more depth than the film does on black undertakers.
Okay, yeah, so there was the consortium of black undertakers that started Greenwood Cemetery, and the assertion that Dr. Phil de Blasi makes is that these guys were like swindled. They borrowed $20,000 from the people who ran Eastern Cemetery as a loan to start Greenwood. Eastern Cemetery used their political power to make sure that the road to Greenwood was not paved. So they did not get the business they expected. And then they, you know, put the cemetery up for auction. Eastern Cemetery bought it. They sent somebody to buy it, and then they bought it from that person. There was always, they always kept like a middleman in between stuff like this, where they were doing like shady, questionable deals. And then after they bought it, then they got the road paved, and they said, hey, Black Undertaker Consortium, you guys owe us this $20,000 plus interest. So that was, I mean, that's kind of the long and short of it, and how he explained it to me. And there was definitely documentation that backed that up.
Fair enough. Now, at one point, I just want to make sure clarify, Babyland is mixed with slaves. They put the slaves there, then Babyland went on top of the slaves.
Okay, so this is the way I understand it. When they built the crematorium, I guess in the 1950s, they did some like terraforming. There was like there's a cliff right there. Just Babyland kind of wraps around the crematorium. It's in back and on the side of it. And then there's like a cliff where it drops off to a lower part of the cemetery, and there's like a fence there. So my understanding is there was like a hilly area where they were going to build, and they like just totally flattened it out. And so there was a bunch of bodies in that area, and that's why it was all saturated into the area that's Babyland on the back and on the side, because that was where they put like all that excess dirt back in, and once they leveled it out to build this building, to build the foundation of it. And that section was quite literally on one of the maps called Old Slave Grounds.
Fair enough. Is there an actual map to this place? If I went to Eastern Cemetery, would there be a map to tell me where everything is now? Is somebody taking care of it?
Like on the premises, you mean?
Or even on the internet?
I'm not sure. I have a map of it. I don't know if there's one online, and I don't think there's one on the premises. All the maps that we have are like older drawings, you know, that were used. But if you're like a person going there and you want to find out where is my family member buried, you want to contact the University of Louisville Archaeology Department, because they have the maps and records there, and they have digitized those, and they will actually, if you contact them, they'll send you that information, like with kind of directions, I guess, and a little map with it.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, how accurate can that map be then, if there everything's all over the place?
It's probably not accurate. I mean, the map would be based on the records, which are obviously falsified in certain cases. And if it's an older burial, if it's not like the most recent burial made there, you know, your guess is as good as mine. Like, I think you may just want to like find a spot and say, this is what I'm thinking. You know, this is going to be my spot where I commemorate that. Because I think that people need somewhere to go and visit their loved ones. But in some cases, yeah, there may not be a definitive answer.
How did you feel when I think it was the whistleblower stated, you put that grave there, period. There was no discussion about it from the top to the bottom.
I cannot tell you what it was like when we sat down with him the first time and he told us those stories. It was absolutely surreal. I've done a lot of interviews since then, for other projects, for work, for lots of, and I've never had that feeling. It was crazy. Like, it was absolutely just a dreamlike feeling of oh my God, holy shit, you know?
Did you feel at any time, or do people come up to you, they need to watch the film twice because of information overload? At least I found that. There's so much stuff here. Like, I thought there should be two parts to this film, or this film should be 3 hours.
Yes, I personally feel that way about it. I mean, that was my biggest concern, was that I should have played it a little slower. But there was actually so much more stuff I wanted to put in that I couldn't put in for time. And I felt like everything that's in there, I was like so passionate about it being in there. So I just kind of did my best to make it move quickly and hopefully keep your attention, but also deliver all of that information. And I'm definitely interested in doing something down the road that would be more comprehensive, but I don't know what that would be yet or if it'll ever actually happen. But it could, like, in my mind, I always say this, it could totally be a Netflix series. Like, there's a whole season's worth of content there for sure.
I was just about to say that. I mean, nothing against your film. I think it's a nice intro to what's here, but I think you have a 10-part series, 100% breaking this down. Each and every part of this thing is just so rich with history.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got the book that Jim Caldwell, the police officer who is investigating there, he started writing a book before he died, and we got the 3 or 4 chapters that he had written, which almost reads like a novel. And I mean, I even have envisioned, like, I would love to tell his story, like, as a movie. I mean, I could see so many, I could see like a true crime podcast from this. So yeah, there's lots of ideas, and it's not something I'm working on right now, but it's something that is definitely on the docket to do more with.
Oh, for sure. Friends of the Eastern Cemetery. You spent a little bit of time with them, but I really wanted to know who these people are. What's their background? Where do they come from? I understand they want to be there to help out, but I wonder a little bit more. Why this cemetery as opposed to doing something else?
Well, as far as Andy, he started the Friends, and he is the Friends to me. But why he did it, I think, is, I mean, we get into it a little bit in the movie, but, you know, he really, I think, just felt a connection with that place. He had no actual reason to ever be there, but he just went there and walked sometimes is how it started, and just started kind of looking into it just out of, you know, curiosity. And I couldn't tell you, I mean, you'd have to ask Andy why Eastern, other than just, you know, when I go there, I get a feeling myself that's, I mean, I think there's like, I'm not going to say it's like a chakra, but you know what I mean? Like, it has a certain presence to it when you're there. And then beyond that, I think it really built out, like, just in such a crazy way. These people are so passionate that you meet that are volunteers there, and it's like their calling, it's their cause. Why? I don't know. But they're really passionate about it. I mean, I think that's the best way I can put it.
So did you have a select questions you would ask each of your interviewees, or did you just go with the flow?
At one time, yes. Like when we did a bunch of interviews over a couple of days with several of the volunteering, everybody, of course, you just like, somebody will say something, you're like, oh, tell me more about that. But we did many interviews over several years, so the questions definitely changed.
Did you find they went deeper as you went further into this?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
When the first person you interview, obviously you're just collecting information. You don't really have a defined interview style. By the time you get to interview 10 or interview 15, you must know what you're looking for and know what questions to ask.
Yeah, definitely. The more it went on, the more questions I had. And so that was good to be able to have more questions to ask people. And a lot of times people didn't know the answer. But I had to go back and sit down with Andy 3 times because
we would interview him and be like, we'd talk for 3 hours. Oh man, we have to have covered everything. And then we would discover something new and we're like, okay, we have to get Andy talking about this. We have to discuss this with him. And he was a part of the detective process too. Like we would call each other like, oh, I talked to this person. I found this article. We were always sending each other everything. So there was definitely, it was very much like detective work. And so as it went on, yeah, we started asking very different questions.
I really want to ask, where did this film first premiere? Did you show it in Louisville?
We did. It was like the weekend before the shutdown hit here because of the pandemic. So it was just like by a crazy miracle. We showed it the same weekend. It came out, I guess, on a Tuesday on iTunes and everywhere online. So that Friday before, I think March 16th, we played it here in a little tiny theater called Village 8, just one showing, packed house, and we did a little Q&A afterwards. That's the only time we've been able to put it on the screen because immediately after that, everything shut down. So we were hoping to maybe do a couple more shows or maybe go somewhere else with it, but that obviously has not been possible.
Okay, it's time for some fun questions.
Okay.
It's your first time on the show, your favorite film?
Oh, gosh. My favorite movie is probably The Big Lebowski.
Nothing wrong with that. Do you have a favorite book on film you recommend to people?
Like an adaptation?
Anything you want to talk about?
Gosh, that's a good question. I love a lot of adaptations. There's so many that I would love to see, too, out of my favorite books. And there's a ton of adaptations I hate. You know, I mean, I think people adapting books is like so difficult. I think the best time it's ever been done to me is probably Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And there's a lot of others that are really questionable. Some of my favorite books have just been ruined by adaptations.
Your last one's quite easy. You're at the movie theater. What snack do you bring with you?
Ooh, candy. Probably like some Sprees if they still have them, but those like don't exist anymore, do they?
I don't even know what
maybe those sweet are. Tarts.
Okay, I know what sweet tarts are. Okay, before I let you go, tell everybody where they can find your wonderful film.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are now on Tubi TV, which is a free app. So I'm telling everybody about that first, but we're also still on Amazon Prime, iTunes, Vudu. There's like all kinds of places that you can find this movie, but I highly recommend go watch it for free on Tubi or Amazon Prime. And we definitely have a Ronin Noir Films Facebook page where you can see like tons of interviews, behind the scenes stuff, all kinds of other content that relates to it. So definitely check all that out for sure.
Well, thank you for your time and have a great day.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.